Support! Lawrence screamed at his team. Support him, for fuck's sake, you pitiful assholes! Now, Sergeant, Captain Bryant's voice carried in faintly from the touchline. No need for that sort of language. Lawrence glared, managing to force out a few words under his breath. Amersey was trying to lift himself off the ground as the victorious Avenging Angels made off with the ball. The hulking hooligans actually had good ball control, Lawrence admitted grudgingly. They nudged it between them, easily beating their way around the one midfielder who tried to intercept them. Where the fuck was the rest of the team? Defense! Lawrence shouted desperately, his arms semaphored wildly. At least his backs had some understanding of tactics. Two were coming forward to take on the Avenging Angels with the ball. Three were guarding the goal area. A midfield duo were heading to the other wing, marking the Avenging Angels' striker who was dodging forward into position. Lawrence saw one of their midfielders heading for an open space in the center circle and ran to cut him off. Not such a bad game after all, and his men could play tough, too. The landmine went off under the Lawrence's loafer defender on the right of the goal area. It blew him 3 meters straight up into the air, taking off his legs and shredding his lower torso. Lawrence dived to the ground at the dull, thudding boom of the explosion. An eerie moment of silence followed. Then the defender's upper torso thumped down, lifeless arms flopping about grotesquely from the jarring impact. His head twisted around to stare blankly at the goal mouth. Lawrence recognized Graham Chappelle, a squatty from Syaran's platoon. Blood and gore splattered across half of the pitch. There was still no sound. Everyone was too shocked even to scream. Lawrence looked around wildly, seeing the steaming crater that had ripped out of the ground, understanding immediately what had happened. Everybody else had flung themselves down. He watched in horror as the ball rolled on, bouncing and juddering across the rucked grass field. Stop! He implored it silently. Oh, fuck, stop! Stop! The damn thing was easily big enough to trigger another mine if it passed over one. It was rolling toward Dennis Eason, who was watching it coming, his face drawn into a rictus of terror and fatalistic expectation. The ball stopped half a meter from him. He let out a sob of relief as his head dropped back to the mud. People were yelling and screaming now, spectators as well as players. They were all flat on the ground. ZB personnel were all shouting at everyone not to move, to stay exactly as they were. Help was on its way. Lawrence clenched his fists, pushing them into the mud, furious at how helpless he was. Waiting with every muscle locked tight in fright and suspense, supremely vulnerable without his skin, open for death from any passing student revolutionary with a whim to be a hero that day. He hated Killboy right then, hated this whole fucking world. That had never happened before, not ever. The best he'd ever come up with before today was animosity and contempt. All they were doing here was playing soccer, for God's sake. Soccer. Their own people as well, few of whom were out of their teens. He could hear the young Avenging Angels around him whimpering in terror, several of them crying. What the hell was wrong with these people? He wanted to shout it out at them. They'd be here watching, relishing the distress and dread they'd created, gloating as the knife was twisted. But all he could do was grit his teeth and lie still, the muddy water seeping into his shirt and shorts, waiting for the glorious sound of the helicopters. 7 platoons were rushed to the park where the soccer game was being played. Their helicopters landed on the roads around the outside. The skins advanced cautiously, sensors probing the ground as they came. They reached every Zhang first, leading the commander away down a safe path marked out by beacon tubes that flashed a bright amber. His helicopter thundered away overhead as the remaining skins spread out over the park, sensors playing back and forth. People were slowly led away one at a time, shaking with relief as they leaned on the squatties. They reached Lawrence 40 minutes after the helicopters arrived. He stood unsteadily, staring around. A confusing grid of amber lights were flashing all across the pitch. 3 red lights gleamed bright among them. One was 4 meters away from where Lawrence had lain. A medic squad was picking up pieces of Graham Chappelle from cleared sections of the pitch, putting him in thick, black polyethylene bags. Bastards, Lawrence hissed as the skin eased him toward the waiting jeeps. You utter bastards! Dean Blanche was ushered into the mayor's study by one of Every Zhang's aides. The commander only needed one look at the carefully blank expression on the internal security captain's face to know it was going to be bad news. So? He asked when the doors were closed. They were our landmines, Captain Blanche said. Shit, are you sure? No, forget that, of course you are. God damn it, how could that happen? We don't understand yet. According to the inventory, they're still in storage. We did a physical check, of course. 8 are missing. 8? Every asked in alarm. How many were planted in the park? He was never terribly at ease with landmines. ZB policy required them to be available in case the situation on the ground became troublesome, and the squaddies had to protect strategic areas from outright aggression. Effectively, that meant the spaceport during their retreat. He was thankful that he'd never had to order their deployment. The damn things were a lethal legacy that could last for decades, completely indiscriminate in choosing their victims. We found 5, with 1 detonated. Oh, Christ. Every went to the small drinks cabinet on the rear wall and poured himself what the locals laughingly described as bourbon. He didn't normally drink in front of his junior officers, and certainly not those from internal security, but it had been a long, bad day, and this wasn't a happy ending. Want one? No, thank you, sir. Your choice. He stood at the French windows, looking up into the night sky. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and the stars were twinkling warmly. After today, he was seriously beginning to wonder if he'd ever make it back up there among them. So we've got 3 mines planted out there somewhere in town, waiting for us to step on them. 2, sir. What? Oh, yes, 2 unaccounted for. Any chance the platoons could have missed them in the park? It's possible, sir. I'm going to order another sweep in the morning when it's light. Good man. Now, how in Christ's name did they get them out of the armory? I'm not sure, sir. Blanche hesitated. It would be difficult. You mean difficult for anyone outside Xantiu Braun? Yes, sir. I can't believe one of our own people would do this. There's no grudge or vendetta worth it. He looked around sharply at the deeply uncomfortable captain. Is there? No, sir. Nothing that serious among the platoons. We're missing somebody. Jones Johnson, the one whose blood they found. Could he have, I don't know, defected? Possible, sir. Is Johnson capable of getting into the armory? I don't know, sir. A lot of the squaddies tend to know shortcuts through our software. Damn it. We have safeguards for a reason, especially on weapons. Sir, I do have 1 possible lead. Yes? The other mines were on standby, and the soccer teams were running all over that field for 30 minutes before the explosion. It must have been activated just before Chappelle ran over it. Every brightened. Killboy transmitted a code. Yes, sir. If it went through the data pool, we can try to trace it. Of course, it could have been an isolated transmitter. In which case, someone had to be close enough to send the code. I can review all the memories from every sensor in the district. The AS may be able to spot someone who fits the right behavior profile. But somewhere in today's data, there should be some evidence. Whatever you need. As much AS time as it takes. You've got it. Your assignment has total priority. Just find this piece of shit for me. I don't care how long it takes, but I'm going to see Mr. Killboy swinging from the top of this town hall before we leave. Chapter 11 Earth, once more. The brilliant white and blue world continued to fascinate Lawrence as much now as it had during his first arrival 5 years ago. As always, during the transfer flight down from Centralis to low orbit, he spent as much time as possible staring at the real-time images provided by the interorbit ship's visual sensors. As they curved in over the Americas, he watched wide swirls of cloud twisting with soft grace out across the western Atlantic, congealing into a single storm spiral, pure white around the ragged edges, but darkening swiftly toward the dense high center as if night were erupting out of its heart. Within days, the Caribbean islands would be cowering from winds and waves and stinging rain, unbound elements stripping the leaves from every tree and washing the land into new shapes. Once again, their population would hunker down and wait for the howling winds to pass. And then afterward, they'd carry on anew, treating the event like an unwelcome holiday. The palms would sprout new fronds, and people would sport and swim on the clean white sands. He smiled down at them from his angel's perch. Only on a world so teeming with life could such acclimatization occur, he thought. A world where life belonged, where symbiosis between nature and environment was the governing evolutionary factor, unlike Amethi. He still held a nest of feelings for his old home world. They weren't as strong now as they had been when he first arrived, and most of them remained antagonistic. But every now and then he could recall times and places from that world when he'd actually been happy or enjoyed himself. None of those times were with Rosalind. He still shielded himself from those recollections. There was too much pain involved, just as sharp and bright now as the day he left. His hand went to the pendant under his shirt. He'd almost flung it away the day he left Amethi. Then he decided to keep it so he would never forget all of the treachery at loose in the universe. Nowadays it was a kind of talisman, proof he'd survived the very worst life could throw at him. The Cianti 5005, carrying them down, landed at Cairns spaceport in the middle of another of Queensland's baking hot afternoons. There was no one waiting to meet Lawrence. He walked past his platoon mates as various families rushed forward in the arrivals hall. Wives and long-term girlfriends flung themselves at their menfolk, clinging tightly and trying not to cry. Until the starship arrived back from Quation 2 days ago, none of them had heard how the asset realization campaign had gone, who was alive, who was injured, who wasn't coming back. Relief and fear echoed through the big air-conditioned hall. Children milled around the embracing couples, smiling and happy that Daddy was home again. There had been a local girl called Sandy, whom Lawrence could reasonably claim to be a regular girlfriend in the time between Floyd and Quation. Sandy had promised to wait for him, but that was just over 9 months ago now. She was 21. He had never seriously expected her to hang around. So he walked out of the terminal building into the clean sea air, taking a long minute to look around at the scrub-covered hills behind the spaceport, looming dark as the sun sank behind them. A humid breeze blowing in from the ocean, gulls squawking, another space plane splitting the air overhead like slow thunder. He smiled around all of it, welcoming the scene as he might an old friend. He would always associate the sea and its smell with Earth. The taxi rank was at the south end of the terminal. Lawrence walked down to it and slung the only luggage he had, his shoulder bag, into the back seat of the elongated white bubble. It had a human driver rather than an AS, an old Chinese man who wanted to talk about how Manchester United was playing this season. He thought Lawrence's accent was British. Never been there, Lawrence had to admit. But you know about Man U? The driver asked anxiously. I've heard of them. Of course you have. Most famous team on the planet. I access every game. I installed a horizontal hologram pane in our apartment so I can watch the whole pitch. My wife doesn't like it. No kidding? Yeah, she wanted a new sofa. I access through membranes as well. The last 3 seasons I've paid the team's media agent for multiplayer viewport feed. It costs, but it's worth it. This way I can see what's happening on the ground as well as get an overview. I like to stay with Paul Ambrose as my viewpoint when the first 11 play. He's got good ball sense. Sounds great. First 11 only play once every 4 days. I have to make do with second 11 and third 11 in between. Uh-huh. Afternoons, I access the under-21 side. Sometimes I have to record them when I'm working. My friends in the other cabs, they have fun trying to tell me who wins. I turn my data pool access off, and they drive up next to me and shout the result. I always have to shut my ears those afternoons. One day, when I save up enough, I'm going to Europe to watch them play live. My wife, she doesn't know that. Really. They had cleared the spaceport to merge with the short highway into town. To his left, Lawrence could see the thin strip of protected mango swamps running along the coastline. On his right, suburban apartments had colonized the land almost up to the foothills. You just down from Quation? Yep. Your wife not meet you? Not married. Wise man. You enjoy yourself while you still can, my friend. When I go to Europe, I won't take my wife. So, you got anywhere to stay tonight? Lawrence could have returned straight to barracks. It wouldn't have cost him anything. But the whole fleet was on 4-week leave, and the bonus pay for the campaign was sitting in his bank, as well as the whole 9 months' back pay. He'd made no plans at all. Some of the other single guys on the starship were talking about sailing between Pacific Islands and raising hell on every beach resort they landed on. Colin Schmidt had invited him on a tour of the casinos in Hong Kong and Singapore. Others promised Perth still rejoiced in its claim to be party capital of the Southern Hemisphere, an easy train ride away. No, he said, I don't have anywhere to stay. He pressed the window key and let the glass slide halfway down. Wind and highway noise rushed in. Up ahead, the glare of lights from the strip was already flickering through the town's outlying buildings. Lawrence laughed at the sight of the gaudy neon and holograms beckoning him back greedily. He'd never been so perfectly content. No cares, no obligations, plenty of money and lots of time to spend it in. Life didn't get much better. I know some places, the taxi driver said, giving him a hopeful sideways glance. I'm sure you do. Okay, what I want is a decent hotel, maybe one with a pool. Not too expensive, but somewhere with a wideband data pool feed and 24-hour room service. And where they don't mind me bringing a guest home for the night. Got that? Ah, the taxi driver nodded happily. I know just the place. The hotel was just on the seedy side of its 2-star rating, but it did have a pool, and Lawrence's second-floor room had a tiny balcony that looked over the gray geometrical sprawl of Southern Cairns. He checked in and wandered down the nearest shopping street, a broad glassed-over concourse whose bargain customers had successfully repelled the bigger chain stores from investing. He bought some clothes in the small shops, nothing too sharp, just something that he could wear out on the strip, and that didn't have a ZB logo. He scored with a girl early on that night, a great roundabout walker in her late teens, out on the road with her friends, backpacking their way around the coast of Australia. She was pretty and slim, with olive skin and her dark hair arranged in tight braids that had colored phosgene beads dangling on the end. When she moved her head quickly, they twirled round like a rainbow halo. He sweet-talked her away from her friends before they all hurried back to the hostel and their pre-booked cots. She was fascinated that he'd actually been born on another world, appreciative of the classy foreign bottled beer his money bought, and showed a keen interest in the fact he'd spent months away from Earth. Deprived, huh? I guess you could say that, he admitted. The natives weren't very friendly. Back in the secluded shadows of his room, she screwed like an energetic kangaroo, pounding away up and down on top of him. For the first hour, he was sure the dilapidated old bed was going to give way under them. He poured more of that expensive beer over her chest and licked it off before she pushed his head down between her legs. They accessed a thrash rock feed and tried to fuck in time to the thumping music, eventually collapsing in howls of laughter as the codpiece-endowed vocalist screeched out lyrics about giving his baby some hard-assed lovin'. Room service delivered club sandwiches with more drink, and they sat cross-legged on the sagging mattress feeding each other. Then they watched a non-eye comedy show before fucking again. She left first thing in the morning to join up with her friends. They were heading farther north, hoping to get some casual work in Port Douglas to pay for the next leg of their great middle-class adventure. By midday, Lawrence had to think hard to remember her name. That next night, it was another girl. She liked highballs instead of beer and electric jazz rather than rock, but she was just as randy. The whole of his first week passed the same way. Sleep during the day, have a decent meal in mid-afternoon, take a walk before the evening started, hit the strip after the sun went down. Some days he ran into other squaddies from the fleet and they'd have a few rounds together, maybe shoot some pool or spend an hour in one of the game arcades. He never got drunk. There was no percentage in that, given his end play. Once or twice he went out on a club's dance floor. Each time it was because the girl was keen to dance first. 7 days after he landed, his bracelet Pearl received a message from Fleet Administration ordering him to report to the base. His application for Starship Officer College had been processed. He was going to be forwarded to Amsterdam for entry assessment. He sat up in bed, holding his glasses up in front of his face, reading the message again with a slow-growing sense of delight. His life was finally coming together the way he wanted. His father, Rosalind, Amethi, that was paying his dues. He'd earned his place on ZB's starships. The girl lying in the bed beside him lifted her head and peered around the hotel room in classic morning-after confusion. She blinked at Lawrence. Her expression changed to one of recognition. "Hi," she grunted. "Morning." "Good news?" She nodded at the glasses he was holding. Lawrence considered the question. The obvious thing to do would be blurt out the assignment, tell her about what it meant to him. It was the kind of thing that should be shared, leading on to a happy day spent together, perhaps a good meal with a bottle of champagne. But, truthfully, the only person he could tell who'd appreciate what it meant was Intoko, and he was pretty sure the corp wouldn't want his own family vacation interrupted by a babbling Lawrence Newton bragging how he was leaving the platoon behind. That was when he admitted to himself just how lonely he'd become. There really was nobody to call. Nobody on this whole planet who knew him. Nobody who cared about him. He dropped the interface glasses back on the bedside table, then pulled the sheet back off the two of them. A few blades of morning sunlight had crept round the curtains, falling on the bed to illuminate their bodies. The girl gave him an uncertain little smile as he gazed at her. For all of their intimacy during the night, he felt nothing, no connection, no urge to try and make it work. The only reason she was here was for sex. He didn't even feel guilty about that. She'd been eager enough. To think, after one night with Rosalind, he'd been ready to spend the rest of his life with her. God, how stupid had he been back then? Talk about being straight off the farm. He could teach her a thing or two now. As always, that treacherous little thought sprang up. I wonder what she's doing now. Nothing important, he said brusquely, angry with himself for the weakness. Then he rolled closer and put his mouth over the girl's ear and, in a throaty, demanding whisper, told her what he wanted from her. With a slight show of reluctance, she positioned herself over the edge of the bed the way he instructed, so he could celebrate with her the only way it was ever going to happen between the two of them. Lawrence took one of ZB's twice-daily flights from Cairns to Paris, a big subsonic passenger jet that refueled at Singapore. From Paris, he transferred to a train that whisked him across the heavily forested European countryside to Amsterdam. He arrived at the old central station that backed onto the harbor in the middle of the city. Cairns, with its eternal heat, had made him forget it was only spring in the northern hemisphere. He pulled his full-length coat on as he walked out of the station, but didn't bother to do it up. The sun was shining out of a clear sky, warming the air. Outside, Prince Hendrik Kada seemed to be a 20-lane road given over entirely to bicycles. He'd never seen so many of the machines in one place before. They were all the same silk-white color with the city emblem embossed on the central spar. Bells rang all around him, making him twist his head about in alarm. Twice he had to jump sharply out of the way as cyclists sped toward him. They obviously weren't going to swerve. Optronic membranes threw up a city map, and he set off down Damrak. the long broad road opposite the station. Trams trundled along rails embedded in the cobbles. He'd never seen machines that looked so ancient, although they were in perfect condition. It was good to be walking through a city and for once not have to be on guard. Quation had not given ZB a joyful reception, but here the citizens smiled warmly when they saw his mauve uniform. He wasn't surprised. According to the briefing he'd downloaded from the company memory, ZB was a heavy investor in Holland, and where their primary installations were based sprang up a host of smaller companies to provide support, both specialist and general. The country had a high prosperity index, even by European standards. His first hint of disenchantment came right outside the officer college. ZB's Amsterdam headquarters, containing the college, was a big five-story stone building that was 80 years old, although its exterior had been crafted in 19th-century bleak, with tall vertical slit windows. Squatting across a broad cobbled square from the fortress-like royal palace, its architecture was more than appropriate. A small group of demonstrators were clustered around some kind of stall 20 meters from the main entrance. Potatoes were baking in what had to be the most primitive oven on the planet, a cylinder made out of solid iron. Charcoal glowed behind a grate on the front end, while a black chimney stack at the rear made the whole thing look like the boiler from some kind of steam engine. The sign above the stall was offering the potatoes with a dozen different fillings. Very cheaply, too, Lawrence noticed. There was an emerald green circle at one end of the sign with a stylized white bird emblem in the middle, its wings swept wide. None of the pedestrians filling the square seemed interested in buying the potatoes. The demonstrators, mostly young people, were singing in not-too-tight harmony, which was presumably putting off the prospective customers. Lawrence didn't know the song. It seemed to be some kind of folk chant, with the ragged voices rising defiantly for the chorus. "Give us back to ourselves. Take back your money. Give us back to ourselves. Turn back your starships. Give us back to ourselves." Several of them were carrying hologram panes on long poles, blazing with anti-ZB slogans. A couple of bored police officers were standing 15 meters away, watching over them. They catcalled and jeered anyone walking up and down the broad stone stairs to the entrance of the big headquarters building. ZB personnel, scurrying in and out, studiously ignored them. When Lawrence started up the stairs, they directed several insults at him. He smiled and waved cheerfully, knowing how much that always annoyed their type. His gaze found a girl in the middle of the group, more attractive than any of her cause sisters, with compact, dainty features amplifying her intent expression. She was wrapped up in an old-fashioned navy blue duffel coat with wooden toggles, its hood down to show off raven hair that had been frizzled into a thick mass of short curls. Their eyes met, and he broadened his grin to a male ape invitation. He laughed heartily at the angry scowl she fired back at him. Minority cause fascists. No sense of humor. Three receptionists sat behind a curving teak desk in the vast, empty lobby. One of them gave him directions to the officer college in an annex of its own at the rear of the main building. "What are they here for?" he asked, pointing out through the tall glass doors at the protesters. "Regressors," she said. "They want us to go away and stop influencing their lives with our policies." "Why?" The receptionist gave him a pitying look. "We're not democratic." "But anyone can buy a stake in ZB. Tell them." The office college was a modern glass cube connected to the headquarters building by a couple of bridges on the third and sixth floors. Lawrence walked across the lower one, trying to damp down his trepidation. If all went well, he'd be spending the next 3 years here, learning everything from life support engineering to astrogration. Although quite why the flattest country in the world had been chosen as the training ground for starships was a question that his downloaded briefing had never covered. Someone somewhere in the company must have had a strong sense of irony. He reported into the corporal in the foyer, saluting sharply. The man gave a disinterested wave back and entered Lawrence into the administration AS. Turn up at 0715 hours tomorrow, the corporal said. You will receive your introduction to the assessment week. This is your accommodation warrant. He handed over a small card. You're staying at the Holiday Inn. This entitles you to a single bedroom along with breakfast and dinner. Don't try ordering room service or beer with it. You have your lunch here in the mess. You're in group Epsilon 3. Don't be late. The corporal returned to the pain displays on his desk. Thanks. How many others in the group? 30. And how many places are we competing for? The corporal gave him a tired look. We process one group per week, and the initial intake is 100 officer cadets. Work the odds out for yourself. Lawrence made his way back through the main building. On average, they'd take two from each group. A 1 in 15 chance. No, he corrected himself. Nothing here is down to chance. I'm going to make it. When he walked into the Holiday Inn, half of the people in the lobby were from ZB, and several of them were obviously in town for their officer assessment. He could spot them a long way off. In their early 20s, fit, serious expressions, well-cut clothes, trying to hide fluttering nerves. He guessed they could spot him just as easily. That afternoon, he went down to the basement pool and swam a mile. As always, his fitness had suffered on the starship back from Quation, and the last week hadn't exactly been dedicated to healthy living. He climbed out, reasonably pleased with his time. The exercise gave him that extra degree of confidence for tomorrow. Thanks to their own training, ZB had kept him in top shape for the last 5 years. Lawrence couldn't stand the idea of having his supper in the hotel restaurant. The place would be full of all the other candidates, forcing themselves to be polite to each other. So he set off on a short walk through the old city as dusk fell. Amsterdam's heart had been beautifully preserved, with marvelous old buildings lining the canals, each with its own hoist on the top. The antique mechanisms still worked, hauling furniture up so it could be brought in through the windows. Houseboats were tied up on the still black water between the arched stone bridges, ranging from tiny cruisers to barges with double decks and roof gardens. Berths had become so valuable that the city hadn't issued a new houseboat license for over 2 centuries. His briefing had mentioned that some had stayed in the same families for over 8 generations now. The bar he eventually found on Rembrandt Plain served a decent menu of hot food and beer that claimed to replicate the recipe of an original Dutch lager. It wasn't the classiest place in town, but it had a lively atmosphere, and a hologram pane was showing a sport feed. He sat at a table near the back and ran through the menu. It took him a moment to work out that the last 10 items on the sheet were narcotics, 3 of which were quite hard. There was an option to have some of the lighter ones as garnish on your food. His waiter took the order and delivered some of the supposed original-tasting lager. Lawrence settled back and took a look around. The big pane on the far wall was showing Manchester United versus Monaco. He chuckled and took another sip of his lager. The girl from the protest group was sitting up at the bar, giving him a cool stare. He did a double take, then smiled and raised his glass in salute. She looked away hurriedly. Too bad, he thought. She was with a couple of other girls, no male companion in sight. Her duffel coat was slung over the back of her stool. She was wearing a thin scarlet roll-neck sweater with an impractically long scarf wound loosely around her neck and baggy olive-green trousers held up with a broad rainbow bead belt. With those clothes and an age he estimated at 3 or 4 years younger than himself, she had to be a student. Philosophy, no doubt, he decided. That or sociology, something utterly useless for the real world. His food arrived. Pasta with a 3-cheese sauce and smoked ham. A side order of garlic dough balls. Sprinkling of ground pepper, hold the hashish. He wound the first strands around his fork. Killed anyone today? He glanced up. The girl was standing by his table. Just like Rosalind, appearing out of nowhere to talk to me. Somehow, he thought the motive would be different. Not today, Nor any day, he answered, politely casual. Her nose was too broad to make her a classic beauty, but she had what people called a fierce intelligence lighting her eyes, analyzing and judging everything she saw. It made her very appealing, that and the raw hostility. Getting her into bed would be quite a challenge. You're one of the cyber soldiers, she said. I can see the blood valves on your neck. She had an accent he couldn't quite place. And you're a welfare princess. I saw you standing in the Dom Square while everyone else was working for a living. Her cheeks darkened in anger. I devote my time to achieving something worthwhile. Your downfall. Had any success? Lawrence had heard of opposites attracting, but this was ridiculous. He was sure she was about to throw her drink over him, except her glass was back on the bar. She couldn't be carrying a weapon, could she? We will, she said. So who do you plan to control our factories and revitalization projects once you've driven us out of your country? Yourself and your friends, perhaps? We'll close down your factories. We don't want that kind of society. Ah, green anarchy. Interesting ideology. Good luck convincing everyone to adopt it. I'm wasting my time. You're not allowed to think. You just recite company dogma. Next, you'll tell me to buy a steak if I want to change the way things are. Lawrence closed his mouth before he said, Well, yes, actually. Are your career and your stake worth so much that you have to build them up on the destruction of others? She looked so damn earnest when she asked him. It was the worst kind of student politics. We can change the whole world if we can just open a dialogue. Try opening a dialogue to a mob flinging Molotovs at you. I've never destroyed anyone, he said lightly. You've taken part in the campaigns to pillage other worlds. If that's not destruction, I don't know what is. Nothing is destroyed, and our campaigns help fund the greatest human endeavor there is. What's that? Establishing colonies on new worlds. My God, you're worse than a cyber soldier. You're an ecocide advocate. It's even worse than that, actually. I'm here in Amsterdam to join the Starship Officer College. I'm going to find lots of new planets we can ecocide. Her head was shaken in soft disbelief. Why? She asked, genuinely puzzled. Why would anyone do such a thing? That's what I never understand about your kind. Why do you always think that you can only achieve anything by violating what's right and natural? If you have this urge, why can't you channel it into something creative? Exploring the universe is the most creative endeavor there could possibly be. It's the culmination of 1,000 years of civilization. Starflight is the most appalling waste of resources and money. ZV is practicing interstellar imperialism with its expansion program. There's no worthwhile outcome. We have a planet here that desperately needs our help in just about every domain you can mention, and we can't provide that help because you're bleeding us to death. ZB provides almost as much funding for ecological and urban revitalization projects as it does for Starflight. But they're your revitalization projects, revitalizing in your image, spreading the dead corporate uniculture into weaker societies. Look, I can see where you're coming from. You want money devoted to issues you think are important. That's perfectly natural politics, convincing governments or corporations to pay for your own pet projects, or convincing enough people to win you the popular vote. Fine, keep on campaigning and raising people's awareness. But you will never, ever get my vote, because I will always vote for more starships. And the only practical way I get those is through a stake in ZB. Sorry, I'm not going to be converted. I'm already doing the one thing I believe in the most. It's wrong, and in your heart you know that. I do not know that. I'm afraid all your arguments fall down with me for the simple reason that you can't look above your own horizon. You have no sense of wonder, no drive. You've limited yourself to seeing only the smallest pixel in the picture. You practice the worst sort of parochialism. I see this whole world and how it's hurting. Exactly. This world and no other. Without Starflight, I would never have been born. I'm not from this planet. He smiled at her frown of confusion. I'm from Amethi, and we don't practice ecocide there. We're regenerating an entire living biosphere, something I happen to think is worthwhile in the extreme. You weren't born on Earth? She asked. That's right. Yet you came here to join CB so you could fly starships further into the galaxy? Yep. Her short laugh was of pure incredulity. You're crazy. Guess so. Lawrence grinned back. So, are you going to wish me luck for my assessment tomorrow? No, that I can never do. Her expression was sorrowful as she turned away. Hey, he called. You didn't tell me your name. For a moment he thought she was going to ignore him. Then she glanced back over her shoulder, hand running through her buoyant hair as she made the decision. Juna, she said at last. Juna Beaumont. Juna, that's good, I like that. I'm Lawrence Newton, and I wish you a happy life, Juna. Finally, just before she reclaimed her bar stool, she allowed him to see a slight smile tweak her lips. Breakfast was as depressing as Lawrence expected it to be. The Holiday Inn restaurant was full of his fellow candidates, all being hearty and cheerful. He joined in, putting on that same mannerly facade, the way he'd learned back home when his father had other board members at the house, and he had to be a proper little Newton. It was surprising how easily the deceit came. The other hopefuls were mostly from upper management families with big stakes in ZB, fresh out of college or with a few years spent in one of the company's various spaceflight divisions. Dressed in his strategic security uniform and with his starflight experience, Lawrence soon became their focal point. They kept him busy answering questions throughout the meal. He was still telling them about Floyd and the aliens when they walked en masse over to the headquarters building. Lawrence looked around the square, but there was no sign of any protesters. Not that he'd expected them there quite so early in the morning. Group Epsilon 3's morning started with the introduction, a half-hour talk from a captain about what ZB looked for in its starship officers. The usual bull about devotion to duty, comradeship, professionalism. Lawrence got a different version from a strategic security officer every time the platoon was put through a new training course. The captain ended with, "We expect you to give us better than your best." Day one was devoted to testing their reflexes. The college's eye environment was the most sophisticated Lawrence had ever experienced. They were given full STEM suits to wear, a tight-fitting one-piece made from a fabric of piezoelectric fibers, then led into a big anacoustic room with three rows of gyro seats. Once they were strapped in, the AS started off with simple coordination tasks. It was easy to begin with. Three-dimensional grid alignments, like being inside a hologram pane graph, lining up the glowing green and scarlet symbols. They soon progressed to steering fast cars through a maze, and different wheel limitations and engine fluctuations were gradually introduced. Crashes became progressively more violent. After lunch, they were given full aircraft simulations, taking up single-seat jet trainers. That was when the AS began to put them under stress, giving them engine flameouts, failed flaps, spins that were so fast they threatened to make Lawrence vomit. Equipment malfunctions at critical moments, cockpit fires with real smoke blowing in through the suit helmet vents and heat searing their hands and legs. When it was finally over, Lawrence had to grip the gyro seat's support pillar while his legs regained their strength and stopped shaking. There was a noticeable lack of jovial esprit de corps in the locker room afterward as they all showered and changed. It was raining when they came out of the headquarters building, a thin, cold drizzle whipped up by the erratic gusts blowing out of the streets surrounding the square. Juna Beaumont was standing outside, her duffel coat hood up against the weather, stamping her feet on the cobbles. There were only three other protesters with her, and the potato stall was absent. They propped up their panes but couldn't summon up the enthusiasm to shout anything. Lawrence gave her a quick nod, but she didn't respond. He wasn't even sure she saw him. An hour later it had stopped raining, and he made his way back to the bar on Rembrandt Plain. He didn't bother with a table this time, just sat up at the bar and ordered a mixed mango and apple juice. Juna arrived a few minutes later. She saw him immediately, and Lawrence offered the empty stool beside him. There was a moment's hesitation, Then she came over, shaking the water from her coat. "You look frozen," he said. "Can I get you something hot?" She signaled to the barman. "Tea, please. Put a gram in." "It's bad for you, you know," Lawrence said. "What, it glitches your circuits? I don't suppose you'd like to lose control, would you?" "Nothing to do with it. It's a poison, that's all. All medicines are to some degree. That's how they kill germs. It's perfectly natural." "Right. So how did your day go?"
"We made our point."
"Did anybody listen?"
"Being there is our point."
"Then I guess you made it well."
Her tea was delivered.
She gave the barman a smile of gratitude. "You going to ask how my day went?" Lawrence inquired.
"No."
"Okay." Lawrence dropped a 10 easy dollar bill on the counter, stood up, and walked out.
And just how cool is that?
He sort of blew it at the door when he looked back to see how she'd reacted. She hadn't. She was sitting with her elbows resting on the bar, holding the cup of tea to her mouth with both hands. He shrugged and stomped off into the night. Day two was all about puzzles. The AS controlling the eye environment put him on a small tropical island 400 meters long and barely 70 wide. A few palm trees and spindly bushes grew along the central strip, but it was otherwise desolate. He was in charge of a 5-strong party that had been diving along the offshore reef. One of them was badly injured to the extent he couldn't be moved and needed medical care urgently for decompression sickness and unspecified internal organ damage. There were 3 islands nearby, one with a resort complex, the second with an abandoned plankton harvest factory, and the third also deserted, but with another diving party visiting it. The resort was farthest away. The plankton plant was known to have an advanced first aid store with a quasi-AS diagnostic. He had only one boat, which couldn't make it to the resort before the injured man died. There were no communications systems. Lawrence took a quick look at the map, comparing island positions. He left 2 people to look after the injured man and set off in the boat to the 3rd island and the other divers. He told them to go to the plankton factory and take the medical equipment to the injured man, then set out by himself to the resort. With just himself on board, he jettisoned all the surplus equipment he could find, allowing the boat to go as fast as possible. In theory, the medical equipment collected by the other divers should allow the injured man to stay alive while he made the long trip to the resort to alert a helicopter rescue team. The AS allowed the scenario, although the chopper paramedics rebuked him for making the boat trip to the resort by himself. There was an experienced sailor in charge of the other diving team who could have made a faster trip, but the injured man survived. For his second expedition, he was in a deep, rocky canyon in a jungle. His little team was moving a lot slower than anticipated because of the difficult terrain. They were starting to run out of food. The canyon walls were too high to be climbed. Lawrence asked them for their skills and found one member who was proficient with canoes. The team set about chopping down trees and building a makeshift raft. The canoeist was dispatched downriver to contact their base camp. After 2 kilometers, the canoeist encountered rapids too severe for the raft. He had to wait until the rest of the team caught up on foot and helped rebuild the raft so that it could be taken apart and carried around difficult sections. Right idea, not enough thought for the method. An Arctic wilderness came next, with Lawrence by himself at the center of a ring of various equipment caches. To get to the food, which was on top of a pressure ridge, he had to collect the climbing equipment to reach it, but the climbing gear was too bulky and heavy to carry in the backpack. He needed the sledge, which was on the other side of a bottomless gorge. The collapsible bridge to get over the gorge needed the sledge to move it. He just couldn't work that one out, but he did his best, fetching a single coil of rope from the climbing cache and trying to swing across the gorge. He wound up tumbling down into the black abyss when his ice axe anchor broke free. After that came a classic cell maze. The AS put him in a room with 5 doors, each of which led to another room with 5 doors. The hazards were mostly visible, with hinged flagstones, spikes stabbing out of the walls, flames, a pendulum, lions, walls that closed in, cutting wire at neck level, electrified segments, Stones that fell from their ceiling cavities. Tripwire-triggered darts. Moss with an acid sap. Rat swarms. Though there were others like gas and ultrasonics that he didn't find until he was already well into the room. The doors all carried clues to what was in the room on the other side, sometimes numerical. Then there were symbols, star signs, even poetry. He was allowed 5 goes. The farthest he ever got was 8 rooms from his starting place. He was put in a starship just after it had suffered a meteor collision. Environmental support systems were failing, air leaking, power dropping, network glitched, no spacesuit, few tools. He had to make his way from his own badly damaged section to the lifeboat capsule halfway around the life support wheel. After that, the AS dressed him in a spacesuit that was low on oxygen and power reserves, and left him clinging to a small asteroid with his ship on the other side. There were different types of survey sensors dotted across the surface, which he could cannibalize for components and gas as he tried to crawl his way back. The rock's microgravity field was just enough to stop him from achieving orbit by muscle power alone, and weak enough to leave him with all the maneuvering problems of freefall. He actually expired within sight of the little silver craft. The locker room that evening was even more subdued than the previous night. The candidates all looked dazed and shell-shocked. Conversation was all, "But what do you do after that bit where..." He couldn't see any protesters in the square, and the weather was a lot better that evening. High clouds and a dry wind blowing off the land. It was still cold. He quite fancied a hot potato. Juno was in the bar when he arrived, sitting at her usual place with empty stools on either side. None too sure of his status, he left a vacant stool between them and ordered his mango and apple. "Shouldn't you have something stronger?" she asked. "I'd say you've had a hard day." "Alcohol isn't going to help. I've got an even harder day tomorrow. Have to keep a clear head."
"Is it worth it?"
He took a long drink from his tumbler.
"Oh, yes. Doesn't seem it to me. Look at the state of you. What did they do to you in there today?"
"Put it this way. If you ever crash land on a frozen desert populated by flesh-eating zombies, then stick with me. I'll get you out. Piece of cake compared to what I went through."
Juno cocked her head to one side, giving him an interested look. "And how does that help them select their officers, exactly?"
"It's testing our ability to think under pressure. They put us in all kinds of impossible situations today." He rolled the glass between his palms, regarding it with a miserable expression. "I didn't do very well. I lost count of how many times I got killed. Then again, the others were just the same, judging by what they said."
"How good are you?"
"What do you mean?" She slid her hands across the bar, pushing the teacup ahead of her, moving with feline grace as she leaned in toward him.
"I mean, you're a soldier who's seen action. You've been in bad situations for real on those other worlds you plunder, right?"
"Yes, but we're trained in how to deal with hostile crowd or ambush situations. I know what I'm doing."
"Right. But what you're basically taught is how to keep cool under fire. And today they simply turned up the heat. Were those situations genuinely impossible, or did you just flunk them?"
"You don't take many prisoners, do you? I suppose I could have done better in some of them, if I knew more about engineering and stuff."
"Has it occurred to you that these tests were actually dual purpose? It sounds to me like they were testing your character as well as your ability to think."
He slumped down on the stool. "Probably. I'm really up shit creek then."
"Why is that?"
With lazy amusement. Lawrence realized just how stoned she was. "I have no character. You said so yourself."
"I didn't say you had no character. I said you had the wrong character, which for the purposes of today's experiment will serve you well. You're what they want."
"Let's hope so. Are you okay to get home from here?" She straightened up again. "Oh, I don't need any help from you. I have a city bike card. I'll just take one off the rack and zoom, I'm home." She caught the barman's attention and wagged a finger at her cup.
"Same again."
Lawrence drained his juice and stood up. "Take care." He walked
to the far end of the bar where the barman was preparing her tea. "Do something for me," he said quietly to the barman. "When she leaves, call a cab for her. This should cover it." He put an easy 20 on the counter. The barman nodded and pocketed the bill. "Sure thing." Day 3 was linked teamwork. The AS split them into groups of 5 and dropped them into a shared eye environment. There were to be 8 tests. For the first 5, they would rotate the leadership, while the last 3 were to be a group effort. Lawrence's group was given a river to cross for its first task. It was running through a hot, unpleasant jungle, complete with insects that bit exposed limbs and reeking marsh sulfur air bubbling out of the mud along the foot of the banks. Crocodiles peered at them from mid-river, occasionally snapping their jaws in anticipation. Ropes, oil drums, and wooden planks were stacked up on the bank. Even laying all the planks end to end, they weren't long enough to reach across the water. Their designated team leader started snapping out orders. He wanted to build a platform that would go halfway across the river. They would take up the section from behind them and rebuild it out in front to the other bank. Lawrence helped willingly enough, even though he knew they were wasting their time. The scheme was over elaborate. They should be building a raft. He briefly toyed with the idea of slacking off, or maybe not tying off his rope as tight as it needed to be. Not active sabotage, exactly, but as the idea was doomed anyway. There were only 2 places after all, but he guessed the AS would be watching for anything less than 100% commitment. Sure enough, when they turned the bridge into a platform in the water and started trying to build the last section, 2 of them wound up falling in the river along with several planks. The crocodiles moved in eagerly, huge jaws hinging open. For his own command, Lawrence was given the last stone in a hinge to erect. He took a quick inventory of the equipment they'd been given, which was mainly poles, shovels, and ropes, and issued his instructions. They measured the length of the stone and the height of the others. That told them how deep to dig the pit at the base of the stone. With that done, they set about tipping it in, rigging up levers and crude pulleys. This was the part that required a high level of coordinated teamwork, and everyone played his part perfectly, following each of the orders that Lawrence shouted out. Eventually, the massive block tilted upright. Lawrence had a nasty moment when it rocked about, but it stayed upright. It was the final 3 tests that made him irritable and disappointed. There was just too much competition between the group members for them to have their own idea adopted. Lawrence reckoned the AS had deliberately structured the tasks so that there were multiple solutions to each problem. His fellow candidates began to question him and each other, whining and bitching, especially when their own proposals were turned down. When Lawrence was convinced he had the most efficient solution to the second task, he had to shout to make them listen, which they resented. They were competing, not cooperating. The simulations were deviating from the way people behaved in real life. Drawing from his own time in action with the platoon, Lawrence knew there would be a better level of rapport. Hardly anyone spoke when they left that evening. Lawrence heard that there had been near fights in other teams during the last 3 tests. At least his own group had managed to keep reasonably civil. That must count in their favor. Juna was in the square. The potato stall was back, along with a larger number of protesters. She caught sight of him and intercepted him. Lawrence tried to smile off the startled looks of the other candidates, though he knew exactly what they must be thinking. "Yours," Juna said curtly, pressing an easy 20 into his hand. "I don't need your charity." "It wasn't charity. I was concerned about you, that's all." "Did I ask you to be?" "How could you? You didn't know what planet you were on." She turned quickly and started walking back to her friends. "I've survived in this city long before you got here, space boy." "Sorry I cared," Lawrence shouted after her. He had dinner in the Holiday Inn that evening. Day 4 was interviews and evaluation. First time up, Lawrence was quizzed by 2 college officers about his background and motivation and likes and dislikes. He knew he had to be courteous and slightly self-deprecating and honest and relaxed and show he had a sense of humor as well as being overwhelmingly interesting. Tall order, cramming those traits into 90 minutes while you're telling them your life history and slanting it so that your inquisitors believe they cannot possibly afford to let you slip out of the college. The second interview was with an assistant to the deputy principal, a cheery old woman who dressed in clothes a century out of date, presumably to give her an authoritative schoolmarmish air. They sat on opposite sides of a steel-blue desk in her office, a fourth-story room with a good view out over the canal. Data was scrolling down her desktop pane, which was just at the wrong angle for him to read it. "You did very well on the simulations," she said. "Good reflexes, good spatial instinct, whatever that is. High proficiency on logical analysis. Integrated well with the group command dynamics. Fast thinker. Care to comment on any of that, Mr. Newton?"
"We were a mess in the last three simulations yesterday. Too much competition."
"That's right. That's why we include them. Think of it as a measure of how unselfish you can be."
"And was I?"
"You certainly showed awareness of the situation. It was a mature reaction. You have the potential to be an officer."
"Excellent." Lawrence couldn't help his hungry grin.
"Which gives me something of a problem. You see, it's more than proficiency we're looking for this week. Your stake also has to be taken into account. And frankly, there are candidates with an aptitude equal to yours who have a much larger stake in ZB than you."
Lawrence managed to hold on to his expression of polite respect.
"I suspect they all had inherited stakes. It's not actually possible for someone of my rank in strategic security to earn a higher stake than the one I have. A lot of the fleet platoon members opt for a much lower percentage. That should tell you all you need to know about my level of commitment to ZB."
"It does, Lawrence, and it's very impressive, as what your commanding officers report. But the figures speak for themselves, and we have to stick to our chosen method of selection. You understand that, don't you?"
He nodded sharply. "This is a hatchet job," he realized. "She's turning me down. I've failed. Failed." His fingers closed tightly around the end of the chair's armrests.
"Good," she said. "What I'd suggest is that you reapply in another couple of years. With the scores you've accumulated over the last 3 days, we'd welcome you back again for another assessment, and by then your stake should have risen to a suitable percentage."
"Thank you." That was what it boiled down to. Thank you. His life stream denied. Thank you. 5 years devoted to the company, putting his life on the line. Thank you. He'd left his world behind, his life, his family, his one love. Thank you. Thank you. Thank fucking you.
It was sunny and cold when he marched down the stone steps to the square, a cloudless deep azure sky overhead. He blinked at the sharp light, which was what must be making his eyes watery. It was normally dark when he came out of the headquarters building. People got in his way as he walked. He pushed past them, heedless of their protests. Trams, too, they could fucking wait. Bastard cyclists, always in the way. Fortunately, the bar was almost empty, but then it was only 3 o'clock in the afternoon. When the evening crowd arrived, Lawrence planned on moving back to the hotel where he could call up room service for the rest of the night. He opened the front of his coat and claimed a bar stool. "Margarita. One glass, one jug." He slapped a couple of easy 20s on the bar. "And that's a proper glass with salt."
"Yes, sir." The barman wasn't going to argue. Not yet.
Lawrence dropped his head into his hands and let out a painful sigh, surprising himself by not shrieking in anguish. "Shit! Shit! Shit! Fuck it!" Someone pulled out the stool next to his and sat down, like they didn't have the whole fucking place to choose from. He jerked round angrily to tell them to...
"Oh, I thought I'd better check on you," Juna said in mild embarrassment. "You nearly got run over by a couple of trams."
He turned away. "Enjoy your moment of triumph."
Suffering in others is not a cause for rejoicing.
"In that case, give the hippie philosophy a break. It pisses me off."
"They turned you down?"
"Yeah, all right. They turned me down. Bastards."
"Did they say why?"
"I'm not rich enough." That's what it was in the end. My stake in the company isn't enough. For fuck's sake, I've got a 30% investment in ZV shares. A third of everything I earn goes straight back into the company. What the fuck else do they expect from me?
I don't know. What did you expect from them?
A fair chance. No, not really. I should have known. Me, of all people. I know how companies really work, what really counts.
The barman put his margarita jug down in front of him, pushing a coaster forward for the glass. It was a proper margarita glass with a thin rime of salt around the rim.
What does count? Juna asked.
Internal politics. You want one of these, or have you got to run back to shout at my fellow corporate cyborgs?
We're not exactly on timesheets and shift work.
Lawrence nodded to the barman. Another glass, please.
Waking up was accompanied by its timeless twin. Where am I?
Lawrence opened his eyes to see a long room with a desk and a couple of worn comfy chairs at one end. The floor was bare wooden boards with a couple of rugs thrown down, one of which he was lying on. Opposite him was a broad arched window with thick old curtains drawn. Scraps of street light shone around the edges, casting a dreary sodium yellow illumination against the walls. Several large prints had been hung above the small fireplace, posters for various exhibitions and poetry recitals, decades out of date. Definitely student digs. Brighter slivers of light silhouetted the door. When he lifted his head, he could see a bed at the other end of the room. Juna was sitting on it, her back against the tarnished brass railings. She had a quilt wrapped around her shoulders. A reefer dangled from one hand, its end glowing morosely in the gloom.
Oh, hell, he muttered. At least he was still wearing his uniform. How did I...
I brought you here, she said.
There was a current of humor in her voice.
My turn to rescue you from the bar.
Thanks. He sat up gingerly. Do I owe you a 20?
No, a friend helped get you into the tram. There's a stop close to the end of the street.
Right. He didn't remember much after the third jug of margaritas, just bitching on about ZB and how he would have loved to be the first person to land on a new world. He ran his dry rubber tongue around the inside of his dry mouth. The taste was awful. Apart from that, he wasn't too bad, just stiff from the floor.
How come I don't have a hangover?
I made you take aspirin and vitamin C and a couple of liters of water.
Right. Thanks again.
The mention of water made him want to pee. Badly.
Juna told him where to find the toilet, just outside and down the corridor. Try to be quiet, she said as he hurried out. Everyone else is asleep.
His watch said it was 2:15.
When he got back, she was still sitting at the end of the bed, the reefer down to its last half centimeter. Want some? She asked.
No, thanks. Us cyborgs don't, remember?
Of course.
Look, thanks again for taking care of me. I'd better be going.
Really?
She took a deep drag.
What's waiting for you?
Nothing much, I guess. I've still got 3 weeks leave due. I just don't want to impose on you any more tonight.
If I thought you were imposing, I wouldn't have brought you here.
A sharp tingle moved down Lawrence's spine. He walked over to the bed and knelt down. She didn't say anything, just kept gazing at him with wide eyes.
He took the last of the joint from her fingers and inhaled the way he'd seen it done on the eyes. The smoke was bitter enough to make him cough.
Juna started to laugh.
I win.
Win what?
I got to you.
Yeah. He grinned and took another drag before handing it back.
You got to me. But then you were never going to run off and join the officer college with me, were you?
She shook her head as if she'd been admonished and pouted.
No.
Can I stay here the rest of the night?
Juna nodded.
With you? He asked softly.
She opened the quilt.
She was naked underneath.
When Lawrence woke up in the morning, his earlier confusion was replaced by something close to embarrassment. Classic case of, now what? He was lying along the edge of the bed, the quilt covering him, with his back pressed up against the wall. The mattress really wasn't wide enough for two. Juno was curled up beside him, looking a whole lot more fragile than she had last night. She was thin, skinny enough for her shoulder blades and collarbones to be prominent, and a lot shorter than he recalled. She must have been wearing heels before. Funny, he'd never noticed that. When he tried to pull the quilt up gently around her shoulders, she stirred and woke. Pale blue eyes, he saw, a contrast to her darkish skin.
"Well," she said.
"Morning."
"Yes, it is."
She snuggled up closer, closing her eyes. "Again, now what?" "So, what time do you have to get up?"
Juno's eyes stayed shut.
"You're always in a rush to go nowhere, aren't you?" "That's me."
"I was going to take a break from college. It's getting heavy there for me right now. I hadn't got a plan for getting up."
"You're at college?"
She sighed and sat up. "Yes, the Prodi. It's a complete shithole. They don't even have enough funds to stop the building from falling apart, and the lecturers are all fifth-raters who couldn't get an appointment cleaning the toilets at a decent university." She got up out of bed with a sudden energetic motion and padded over to the window, pulling the curtains back with a quick tug. Lawrence didn't point out she was nude. He would have sounded like his mother. But the window was smeared with dribbles of condensation. Only a few vague gray shapes of building were visible. Juno shivered and rubbed her arms. The air in the room was cold enough to make her breath show as thin vapor.
"Are you leaving me?" she asked.
"Like you, I don't have any plans."
"Actually, I was thinking I'd go to Scotland."
He couldn't figure out if that was an invitation. She certainly wasn't his usual type, not with all this twitchy energy and commitment to her stupid cause. He couldn't imagine her ever walking down the strip at Cairns, hunting a good time as the sun went down. Come to that, he couldn't even imagine her laughing heartily. He'd never seen her do more than smile wryly every now and then. But then again, she definitely knew her own mind, just like Rosalind. Unlike Rosalind, she wasn't happy with life. There was a lot of anger bottled up inside that small frame. A stupid form of anger, though he would never tell her that to her face. She was far too wrapped up in her issues to welcome contrary observations. He guessed that might make her kind of lonely. The room had a singular imprint that was all her own. It wasn't just the air that was cold. Most people, he thought, would instinctively keep their distance. So why didn't I? Two lonely people. Maybe that was why they'd kept dancing around each other in the bar. They weren't opposites attracting, after all.
"I've never been to Scotland," he said.
Juno was bending over the heat store block that sat in the ancient fireplace, turning up its output. The black surface began to glow a deep orange, as if there were still embers in the grate. She gave him a fast, nervous smile.
"You want to come with me?"
There was surprise and hope in her voice.
"Sure, if you want me to come with you."
"I don't mind. It would be nice."
For a moment, he thought she was going to jump back into bed with him. Instead, she grabbed a big red and green checked nightshirt from the back of a chair and struggled into it.
"I'll put some coffee in the microwave," she said. "Then I have to do my yoga. It helps me center myself. We can go after that."
"Okay," he said, trying to keep pace with events. "I can pick up my stuff from the hotel on the way to the station."
"Will you book the train tickets? I hate using the data pool. I can pay you."
"Sure."
He hunted around for his clothes, wondering what he'd gone and said yes to. Lawrence and Juno took an express train straight out of Amsterdam directly to Edinburgh, traveling in a big U down south to Paris, across to London, then up north again to the end of the one-pulse line at Waverley. To start with, Lawrence was impressed by Holland. The old canals were still draining the land. Windmills stood guard along the straight-edged waterways, although little wind now reached their sails, thanks to the extensive forests that had grown up in the last two centuries across the old farmland. There was a huge variety of trees, but with the canals slicing through them,
They formed such a regular grid it made them look like nothing more than fields. In a sense, they were, not that they were cultivated, but the land management teams maintained them carefully. Even now, the drainage system couldn't be allowed to fall into disrepair, and the roots were a big potential hazard. It gave him an impression of an artificial environment barely one step ahead of Amathai. He thought that, in a way, Holland must be the first example of large-scale terraforming, human engineering and ingenuity wresting a livable nation out of an alien environment. Lawrence soon tired of the Fenlands, especially as their speed blurred details. "So why Scotland?" he asked. Juna put her feet up on the table, ignoring the disapproving looks of the other passengers in the carriage. "My grandmother is Scottish. We're going to stay with her."
"Where, exactly?"
"Fort William."
He put his interface glasses on and accessed the data pool to find where that was.
"You spend a lot of time trawling, don't you?" Juna said.
"My education had a lot of holes. You must do a fair bit of accessing yourself."
"As little as possible. I prefer books."
"There's a time and a place for hard copy. My dad had a thing for books, too. I guess that's why I never use them." He grinned at the face she pulled. "What's your subject at Prodi?"
"I'm taking ecological management."
"Right." It wasn't what he expected. "Doesn't that mean you'll wind up working for a company?"
"There are companies, and there are companies.
And then there are government agencies, at least by name. In practice, they're another branch of corporate reclamation and revitalization divisions. But I won't take a job with any of them. There are still some private landowners who use the land in the traditional fashion. They farm or log timber or run stables. That's what I want to keep alive."
"Farming?" he asked skeptically.
"I thought that's what damaged the land in the first place."
"Industrial farming did, yes. Pesticides and nitrates were poured over the soil in the quest for higher yields, and to hell with the consequences. Agricultural machinery actually got so big and so heavy that it compacted the subsoil. By the end, in the developed nations, topsoil was little more than a matrix that suspended chemicals and water so the crop roots could absorb them. Then the companies developed protein cell technology and killed farming altogether."
"And stopped us raising and slaughtering animals for food. I mean, can you imagine how barbaric that was? Eating living things, it's disgusting."
"It's perfectly natural. Not that people think that way today. And I didn't say protein cells are a bad thing. After all, it means no one on Earth starves. But as always, they went to extremes and eliminated every valid alternative. All I'm asking for is to keep a few pockets of independence alive."
"You mean like working museums?"
"No. These are havens for people who reject your corporate uniculture existence. There are more of them than governments and corporations like to admit. More of us."
"Ah, right. Communes of back-to-the-earthers. So would you also be refusing the kind of medical technology that comes out of our wicked corporations?"
She gave him an exasperated stare.
"That's so typical. Denigrate something you know nothing about. I never said I was rejecting technology. It's the current global society that I refuse to obey. Technology doesn't have to come only from corporate labs, to be exploited for profit and policy implementation. It could come from universities, where it would be made freely available to benefit everyone. Even small independent communities could support researchers. If we all had free access to data, we could build a culture of distributed specialization."
"The old global village idea.
Nice, but you still need factories and urban centers. You should know that culture always flourishes at the heart of society." "The data pool is the heart of our society. You're still thinking in physical terms when you talk about cohesion. You can live in a cottage in the middle of a forest with every need taken care of and still be totally in tune with the rest of the world."
"But why live there when you can also live in a city and interact with people and go down to a bar in the evening and have a laugh and a drink? We don't all want to be hermits."
"I know. But your companies don't want anyone to be a hermit or anything else. According to them, we all have to fit into this uniculture they're trying to establish like neat little blocks on a circuit board. I don't want to be a part of that. I want my freedom.
I think you're exaggerating.
She pointed to a badge on her coat lapel. It had a single eye at the center.
Open your eyes.
He managed to steer the conversation off politics and got her talking about music, which was always a relatively safe topic. You could disagree about bands, performers, and composers without storming out or throwing things. She enjoyed orchestral symphonies from several classical and modern composers. From post-electronic music, she listened to what he thought of as ballads and street poetry. Although she had thousands of hours of tracks loaded into her multimedia player card, she became animated about live concerts, telling him about all the venues she'd visited, the bands and orchestras she'd heard. As far as entertainment went, she was scornful of the eyes, although she admitted to watching several current soaps. The eyes, she claimed, were something she grew out of, and she really hated AS-generated dramas, preferring to visit theaters. Amsterdam had a host of small, non-mainstream theaters where her student status got her reduced rates, she said, and the city had hundreds of performance groups eager to put on their works. Lawrence almost pointed out that having so many groups evolve in a city proved his argument about culture, but he still wasn't sure how she'd respond to that kind of teasing. Even after lunch in the buffet car, when she drank over half a bottle of wine, she was still tense. That afternoon, she asked what he enjoyed, and he was foolish enough to admit accessing Flight Horizon. It was the first time he'd ever seen her truly laugh. "I can't believe we export that kind of crap to other worlds," she chortled. "No wonder you have such a screwed-up vision of Starflight. My God! And that ending!"
"Ending?"
"The last episode. Unbelievable. Pretty hot, though."
"You saw that?"
"Yeah. Told you I was into eyes when I was a kid."
"Why?"
Her eyes narrowed, giving him a curious gaze.
"Didn't you see it?"
"No," he said lamely, unwilling to admit the associations the show had for him. Even though he knew he was totally and completely over Rosalind, he'd somehow never quite got round to accessing those last few episodes. "We only ever got a couple of series on Amethi."
"Oh, wow. You've got to access it now you're here. You missed a treat."
"That part of my life is over. I can do without revisiting it, thank you." Her eyebrows rose at the finality in his voice.
"Okay."
Fortunately, she didn't pursue it or even try to tease him. Their conversation rambled on. The one thing that they never mentioned was sex. He found that strange. It was as if last night simply hadn't happened, at least for her. They talked around just about everything else. As he was taking his cues from her, he didn't try to bring it up. He wanted to. Juno was good company, not necessarily pleasant company. If their opinions clashed, she would argue until he gave up. That made her interesting as much as her diametrically opposed worldview. When he thought about some of his barracks conversations, he couldn't believe how dumb they were in comparison. It was that quality he'd first noticed in her, the fierce intelligence, that's what attracted him. So he wanted to know where they stood, which basically meant was she coming to bed with him tonight and every other night of this jaunt. At one point he decided she was saying nothing in order to tantalize him, an intellectual's idea of foreplay. Though there were always doubts about that theory, she was too highly strung to avoid talking about anything important in her life, which made her silence on the subject slightly puzzling. He'd booked a double sleeper cabin for them that night. When she'd paid him for the ticket, there had been no mistake or misunderstanding. She saw exactly what he'd got for them. The thought stayed with him all that afternoon. They'd slung their luggage in there as soon as they got on board, his shoulder bag, her rucksack. The cabin was tiny, its fittings as compact as modern design allowed. All the time they spent talking in the main coach, she knew they'd be going back there after dinner. They'd strip off in the confined space, then climb into the low bunk together. The prospect was highly arousing. It would be almost like their first time. Last night, from what he could recall, had involved little passion and hadn't lasted long anyway. Some perfunctory fumbling brought to a swift climax. First
time sex was always hot, and here on the train it was inevitable, which added that extra twinge of excitement as he spent the afternoon looking at her. They went to the restaurant as the train slid out of Paris. Juno ordered a bottle of red wine. Lawrence had two glasses. She finished the rest and ordered another. Her conversation, which had arrived at the global uniculture's contamination of Africa, allowed less and less opportunity for him to say anything. Eventually, it became a bitter rant. Lawrence didn't have any of the second bottle. Juno ordered a brandy for herself, which she finished before they left for their sleeper cabin.